new era of confidence in the Western world that would put an end to the economic depression which had brought the German people such misery. And it would take the wind out of the Nazi sails. Brüning planned to move boldly on the home front, too, and to bring about by agreement of all the major parties, save the communists, a fundamental change in the German constitution. He meant to restore the Hohenzollern monarchy. Even if Hindenburg could be persuaded to run again, he could not be expected at his age to live out another full term of 7 years. Should he die in another year or two, the way would still be open to Hitler to be elected president. To forestall that, to assure permanency and stability in the office of head of state, Brüning broached the following plan. The 1932 presidential elections would be called off, and Hindenburg's term of office simply extended, as it could be, by a two-thirds vote in the two houses of parliament, the Reichstag and the Reichsrat. As soon as that was achieved, he would propose that parliament proclaim a monarchy with the president as regent. On his death, one of the sons of the crown prince would be put on the Hohenzollern throne. This act, too, would take the wind out of the Nazis. In fact, Brüning was confident that it would mean their end as a political force. But the aged president was not interested. He, whose duty it had been as commander of the Imperial Army to tell the Kaiser on that dark fall day of November 1918 at Spa that he must go, that the monarchy was at an end, would not consider any Hohenzollerns resuming the throne except the emperor himself, who still lived in exile at Doorn in Holland. When Brüning explained to him that the Social Democrats and the trade unions, which with the greatest reluctance had given some encouragement to his plan if only because it might afford the last desperate chance of stopping Hitler, would not stand for the return of either Wilhelm II or his eldest son, and that, moreover, if the monarchy were restored, it must be a constitutional and democratic one on the lines of the British model, the grisly old field marshal was so outraged he summarily dismissed his chancellor from his presence. A week later he recalled him to inform him that he would not stand for re-election. In the meantime, first Brüning and then Hindenburg had had their first meeting with Adolf Hitler. Both talks went badly for the Nazi leader. He had not yet recovered from the blow of Geli Raubal's suicide. His mind wandered, and he was unsure of himself. To Brüning's request for Nazi support for the continuance in office of Hindenburg, Hitler answered with a long tirade against the Republic, which left little doubt that he would not go along with the Chancellor's plans. With Hindenburg, Hitler was ill at ease. He tried to impress the old gentleman with a long harangue, but it fell flat. The president, at this first meeting, was not impressed by the Bohemian Corporal, as he called him, and told Schleicher that such a man might become Minister of Posts, but never Chancellor, words which the Field Marshal would later have to eat. Hitler, in a huff, hastened off to Bad Harzburg, where on the next day, October 11th, he joined a massive demonstration of the National Opposition against the governments of Germany and Prussia. This was an assembly not so much of the radical right, represented by the National Socialists, as of the older conservative forces of reaction. Hugenberg's German National Party, the right-wing veterans' private army, the Stahlhelm, the so-called Bismarck Youth, the Junkers Agrarian League, and an odd assortment of old generals. But the Nazi leader did not have his heart in the meeting. He despised the frock-coated, top-hatted, bemedaled relics of the old regime, with whom he saw it might be dangerous to associate a revolutionary movement like his own too closely. He raced through his speech in a perfunctory manner and left the field before the parade of the Stahlhelm, which, to his annoyance, had shown up in larger numbers than the SA. The Harzburg Front, which was formed that day and which represented an effort of the old-line conservatives to bring the Nazis into a united front to begin a final assault on the Republic, it demanded the immediate resignation of Brüning, was thus stillborn. Hitler had no intention of playing second fiddle to these gentlemen, whose minds, he thought, were buried in the past to which he knew there was no return. He might use them for the moment if they helped to undermine the Weimar regime and made available to him, as they did, new financial sources, but he would not, in turn, be used by them. Within a few days, the Harzburg Front was facing collapse. The various elements of it were once more at each other's throats. Except on one issue. Both Hugenberg and Hitler refused to agree to Brüning's proposal that Hindenburg's term of office be prolonged. At the beginning of 1932, the Chancellor renewed his effort to get them to change their minds. With great difficulty, he had prevailed on the President to agree to serving further if Parliament prolonged his term, and thus made it unnecessary for him to have to shoulder the burden of a bitter election campaign. Now, Brüning invited Hitler to come to Berlin for fresh discussions. The telegram arrived while the Führer was conferring with Hess and Rosenberg in the editorial offices of the Völkischer Beobachter in Munich. Thrusting the paper into their faces, Hitler cried, "Now I have them in my pocket! They have recognized me as a partner in their negotiations." On January 7th, Hitler conferred with Brüning and Schleicher, and there was a further meeting on January 10th. Brüning repeated his proposal that the Nazi Party agree to prolonging Hindenburg's term. If this were done, and as soon as he had settled the problem of cancellation of reparations and equality of armaments, he himself would retire. According to some sources, it is a disputed point, Brüning held out a further bait. He offered to suggest Hitler's name to the president as his successor. Hitler did not immediately give a definite reply. He adjourned to the Kaiserhof Hotel and took counsel with his advisers. Gregor Strasser was in favor of accepting Brüning's plan, arguing that if the Nazis forced an election, Hindenburg would win it. Goebbels and Röhm were for an outright rejection. In his diary for January 7th, Goebbels wrote, "The presidency is not the issue. Brüning merely wants to strengthen his own position indefinitely. The chess game for power begins. The chief thing is that we remain strong and make no compromises." The night before, he had written, "There is a man in the organization that no one trusts. This is Gregor Strasser." Hitler himself saw no reason to strengthen Brüning's hand and thus give the Republic a further lease on life. But unlike the thick-headed Hugenberg, who rejected the plan outright on January 12th, Hitler was more subtle. He replied not to the Chancellor but over his head to the President, declaring that he regarded Brüning's proposal as unconstitutional, but that he would support Hindenburg's re-election if the Field Marshal would reject Brüning's plan. To Otto von Meissner, the nimble Secretary of State at the Presidential Chancellery, who had zealously served in that capacity first the socialist Ebert and then the conservative Hindenburg, and who was beginning to think of a third term in office for himself with whoever the president might be, perhaps even Hitler. The Nazi leader, in a secret conversation at the Kaiserhof, offered to support Hindenburg in the elections if he would first get rid of Brüning, name a national government, and decree new elections for the Reichstag and the Prussian Diet. To this, Hindenburg would not agree. Nettled by the refusal of the Nazis and the Nationalists, the latter his friends and supposed supporters, to agree to spare him the strain of an election battle, Hindenburg agreed to run again. But to his resentment against the Nationalist parties was added a curious spleen against Brüning, who he felt had handled the whole matter badly, and who was now forcing him into bitter conflict with the very nationalist forces which had elected him president in 1925 against the liberal Marxist candidates. Now he could win only with the support of the socialists and the trade unions, for whom he had always had an undisguised contempt. A marked coolness sprang up in his dealings with his chancellor, the best, he had said not so long ago, since Bismarck. A coolness toward Brüning also came over the general who had propelled him into the chancellorship. To Schleicher, the austere Catholic leader had been a disappointment after all. He had become the most unpopular chancellor the Republic had ever had. He had been unable to obtain a majority in the country. He had failed to curb the Nazis or to win them over. He had bungled the problem of keeping Hindenburg on. Therefore, he must go, and perhaps with him General Gruner, Schleicher's revered chief, who did not seem to grasp the ideas for the future which he, Schleicher, had in mind. The scheming general was not exactly in a hurry. Brüning and Gruner, the two strong men of the government, must remain in power until Hindenburg was re-elected. Without their support, the old field marshal might not make it. After the elections, their usefulness would be over. Hitler against Hindenburg. There were a number of occasions in the career of Adolf Hitler when, faced with a difficult decision, he seemed unable to make up his mind, and this was one of them. The question he faced in January 1932 was, to run or not to run for president. Hindenburg seemed unbeatable. The legendary hero would be supported not only by many elements of the right, but by the Democratic parties which had been against him in the election of 1925, but which now saw him as the savior of the Republic. To run against the field marshal and be beaten, as he almost certainly would be, was that not to risk the reputation for invincibility which the Nazis had been building up in one provincial election after another since their spectacular triumph in the national poll in 1930? And yet, not to run, was that not a confession of weakness, a demonstration of a lack of confidence that National Socialism was on the threshold of power? There was another consideration. Hitler was at the moment not even eligible to run. He was not a German citizen. Joseph Goebbels urged him to announce his candidacy. On January 19th, they journeyed to Munich together, and that evening Goebbels recorded in his diary, "Discussed the question of the presidency with the Führer. No decision has yet been reached. I pleaded strongly for his own candidacy." For the next month, the diary of Goebbels reflected the ups and downs in Hitler's mind. On January 31st, "The Führer's decision will be made on Wednesday. It can no longer be in doubt." On February 2nd, it seemed that he had made it, Goebbels noted. "He decides to be a candidate himself." But Goebbels adds that the decision will not be made public until it is seen what the Social Democrats do. Next day, the party leaders assemble in Munich to hear Hitler's decision. "They wait in vain," Goebbels grumbles. "Everyone," he adds, "is nervous and strained." That evening, the little propaganda chief seeks relief. He steals away to see Greta Garbo in a movie and is moved and shaken by this greatest living actress. Later that night, "A number of old party comrades come to me. They are depressed at the lack of a decision. They fear that the Führer is waiting too long." He may be waiting too long, but Hitler's confidence in his ultimate triumph does not weaken. One night in Munich, the diary records, the Führer has a long discussion with Goebbels on which post the latter will have in the Third Reich. "The leader has in mind for him," Goebbels says, "a Ministry of Popular Education which will deal with films, radio, art, culture, and propaganda." On another evening, Hitler has a long discussion with his architect, Professor Troost, over plans for a grandiose alteration of the national capital. And Goebbels adds, "The Führer has his plans all finished. He speaks, acts, and feels as if we were already in power." But he does not speak yet as if he were anxious to run against Hindenburg. On February 9th, Goebbels records, "The Führer is back in Berlin. More debates at the Kaiserhof over the presidential election. Everything is left in suspense." 3 days later, Goebbels goes over his calculations of votes with the Führer. "It's a risk," he says, "but it must be taken." Hitler goes off to Munich to think it over still further. In the end, his mind is made up for him by Hindenburg. On February 15th, the aged president formally announces his candidacy. Goebbels is happy. "Now we have a free hand. Now we need no longer hide our decision." But Hitler does hide it until February 22nd. At a meeting that day in the Kaiserhof, "The Führer gives me permission," Goebbels rejoices, "to announce his candidacy at the Sport Palace tonight." It was a bitter and confusing campaign. In the Reichstag, Goebbels branded Hindenburg as the candidate of the party of the deserters and was expelled from the chamber for insulting the president. In Berlin, the nationalist Deutsche Zeitung, which had backed Hindenburg's election in 1925, now turned on him vehemently. "The present issue," it declared, "is whether the internationalist traitors and pacifist swine, with the approval of Hindenburg, are to bring about the final ruin of Germany." All the traditional loyalties of classes and parties were upset in the confusion and heat of the electoral battle. To Hindenburg, a Protestant, a Prussian, a conservative, and a monarchist, went the support of the socialists, the trade unions, the Catholics of Brüning's Center Party, and the remnants of the liberal democratic middle class parties. To Hitler, a Catholic, an Austrian, a former tramp, a national socialist, a leader of the lower middle class masses, was rallied, in addition to his own followers, the support of the upper class Protestants of the North, the conservative Junker agrarians, and a number of monarchists, including at the last minute the former crown prince himself. The confusion was further compounded by the entrance of two other candidates, neither of whom could hope to win, but both of whom might poll enough votes to prevent either of the leading contestants from obtaining the absolute majority needed for election. The Nationalists put up Theodor Düsterberg, second in command of the Stahlhelm, of which Hindenburg was the honorary commander, a colorless former lieutenant colonel whom the Nazis, to their glee, soon discovered to be the great-grandson of a Jew. The Communists, shouting that the Social Democrats were betraying the workers by supporting Hindenburg, ran their own candidate, Ernst Thälmann, the party's leader. It was not the first time nor the last that the Communists, on orders from Moscow, risked playing into Nazi hands. Before the campaign was scarcely underway, Hitler solved the problem of his citizenship. On February 25th, it was announced that the Nazi Minister of the Interior of the state of Brunswick had named Herr Hitler an attaché of the legation of Brunswick in Berlin. Through this comic opera maneuver, the Nazi leader became automatically a citizen of Brunswick and hence of Germany, and was therefore eligible to run for president of the German Reich. Having leaped over this little hurdle with ease, Hitler threw himself into the campaign with furious energy, crisscrossing the country, addressing large crowds at scores of mass meetings and whipping them up into a state of frenzy. Goebbels and Strasser, the other two spellbinders of the party, followed a similar schedule. But this was not all. They directed a propaganda campaign such as Germany had never seen. They plastered the walls of the cities and towns with 1 million screeching colored posters, distributed 8 million pamphlets and 12 million extra copies of their party newspapers, staged 3,000 meetings a day, and for the first time in a German election made good use of films and gramophone records, the latter spouting forth from loudspeakers on trucks. Brüning also worked tirelessly to win the election for the aged president. For once, this fair-minded man was ruthless enough to reserve all radio time on the government-controlled networks for his own side, a tactic which infuriated Hitler. Hindenburg spoke only once in a recorded broadcast on March 10th on the eve of the polling. It was a dignified utterance, one of the few made during the campaign, and it was effective. Election of a party man, representing one-sided extremist views, who would consequently have the majority of the people against him, would expose the fatherland to serious disturbances whose outcome would be incalculable. Duty commanded me to prevent this. If I am defeated, I shall at least not have incurred the reproach that of my own accord I deserted my post in an hour of crisis. I ask for no votes from those who do not wish to vote for me. Those who voted for him fell 0.4% short of the needed absolute majority. When the polls closed on March 13, 1932, the results were Hindenburg, 18,651,497 votes, or 49.6%, Hitler, 11,339,446 votes, or 30.1%, Thälmann, 4,983,341 votes, or 13.2%, and Düsterberg, 2,557,729 votes, or 6.8%. The figures were a disappointment to both sides. The old president had led the Nazi demagogue by over 7 million votes, but had just failed to win the required absolute majority. This necessitated a second election in which the candidate receiving the most votes would be elected. Hitler had increased the Nazi vote over 1930 by nearly 5 million, some 86%, but he had been left far behind Hindenburg. Late on the evening of the polling, there was deep despair at the Goebbels home in Berlin, where many of the party leaders had gathered to listen to the results over the radio. "We're beaten. Terrible outlook," Goebbels wrote in his diary that night. "Party circles badly depressed and dejected. We can save ourselves only by a clever stroke." But in the Völkischer Beobachter the next morning, Hitler announced, "The first election campaign is over. The second has begun today. I shall lead it." Indeed, he campaigned as vigorously as before. Chartering a Junkers passenger plane, he flew from one end of Germany to the other, a novelty in electioneering at that time, addressing 3 or 4 big rallies a day in as many cities. Shrewdly, he altered his tactics to attract more votes. In the first campaign, he had harped on the misery of the people, the impotence of the Republic. Now he depicted a happy future for all Germans if he were elected. Jobs for the workers, higher prices for the farmers, more business for the businessmen, a big army for the militarists, and once, in a speech at the Lustgarten in Berlin, he promised, "In the Third Reich, every German girl will find a husband." The nationalists withdrew Duesterberg from the race and appealed to their followers to vote for Hitler. Again, even the dissolute former crown prince, Friedrich Wilhelm, fell into line. "I shall vote for Hitler," he announced. April 10, 1932, the day of the second election, was dark and rainy, and a million fewer citizens cast their votes. The results announced late that night were: Hindenburg, 19,359,983, or 53%, Hitler, 13,418,547, or 36.8%, Thälmann, 3,706,759, or 10.2%. Though Hitler had increased his total vote by 2 million, and Hindenburg had gained only 1 million, the president was in by a clear absolute majority. More than half the German people had thus given expression to their belief in the Democratic Republic. They had decisively rejected the extremists of both right and left. Or so they thought. Hitler himself had much to ponder. He had made an impressive showing. He had doubled the Nazi vote in 2 years. And yet a majority still eluded him, and with it the political power he sought. Had he reached the end of this particular road? In the party discussions that followed the April 10th poll, Strasser frankly argued that this was indeed Hitler's position. Strasser urged a deal with those in power, with the president, with the government of Brüning and General Groener, with the army. Hitler distrusted his chief lieutenant, but he did not dismiss his idea. He had not forgotten one of the lessons of his Vienna days, that to attain power one must win the support of some of the existing powerful institutions. Before he could make up his mind as to the next step, one of these powerful institutions, the government of the Republic, struck him a blow. For more than a year, the Reich government and various state governments had been coming into possession of documents which showed that a number of high Nazi leaders, especially in the SA, were preparing to take over Germany by force and institute a reign of terror. On the eve of the first presidential elections, the SA, now 400,000 strong, had been fully mobilized and had thrown a cordon around Berlin. Though Captain Röhm, the SA chief, assured General von Schleicher that the measure was merely precautionary, the Prussian police had seized documents at Nazi headquarters in Berlin, which made it pretty clear that the SA meant to carry out a coup d'état on the following evening should Hitler be elected president. Such was Röhm's hurry. Goebbels, in a diary notation on the night of March 11th, had confirmed that something was afoot. "Talked over instructions with the SA and SS commanders. Deep uneasiness is rife everywhere. The word putsch haunts the air." Both the national and the state governments were alarmed. On April 5th, representatives of several of the states, led by Prussia and Bavaria, the two largest, had demanded that the central government suppress the SA, or else they would do it themselves in their respective territories. Chancellor Brüning was away from Berlin electioneering, but Gruner, who received the delegates in his capacity of Minister of the Interior and of Defense, promised action as soon as Brüning returned, which was on April 10th, the day of the second election. Brüning and Gruner thought they had good reasons for stamping out the SA. It would end the threat of civil war and might be a prelude to the end of Hitler as a major factor in German politics. Certain of Hindenburg's re-election by an absolute majority, they felt that the voters were giving them a mandate to protect the Republic against the threats of the Nazis to forcibly overthrow it. The time had come to use force against force. Also, unless they acted vigorously, the government would lose the support of the Social Democrats and the trade unions, which were providing most of the votes for Hindenburg and the chief backing for the continuance of Brüning's government. The cabinet met on April 10th in the midst of the polling and decided to immediately suppress Hitler's private armies. There was some difficulty in getting Hindenburg to sign the decree. Schleicher, who had first approved it, began to whisper objections in the president's ear. But he finally did so on April 13th, and it was promulgated on April 14th. This was a stunning blow to the Nazis. Röhm and some of the hotheads in the party urged resistance to the order. But Hitler, shrewder than his lieutenants, ruled that it must be obeyed. This was no moment for armed rebellion. Besides, there was interesting news about Schleicher. Goebbels noted in his diary on that very day, April 14th, "We are informed that Schleicher does not approve Gruner's action." And later that day, a telephone call from a well-known lady who is a close friend of General Schleicher. She says the general wants to resign. Goebbels was interested but skeptical. "Perhaps," he added, "it is only a maneuver." Neither he, nor Hitler, nor anyone else, certainly not Brüning, and most certainly not Gruner, to whom Schleicher owed his rapid rise in the army and in the councils of government, had as yet surmised the infinite capacity for treachery of the scheming political general. But they were soon to learn. Even before the ban on the SA was promulgated, Schleicher, who had won over the weak-minded commander of the Reichswehr, General von Hammerstein, confidentially informed the commanders of the 7 military districts that the army opposed the move. Next, he persuaded Hindenburg to write a cantankerous letter to Gruner on April 16th, asking why the Reichsbanner, the paramilitary organization of the Social Democrats, had not been suppressed along with the SA. Schleicher took a further step to undermine his chief's position. He inspired a malicious smear campaign against General Gruner, spreading tales that he was too ill to remain in office, that he had become a convert to Marxism and even to pacifism, and proclaiming that the defense minister had disgraced the army by having a child born 5 months after his recent marriage. The baby, he told Hindenburg, had been nicknamed Nurmi in army circles, after the fleet Finnish runner of Olympic fame. In the meantime, Schleicher renewed his contacts with the SA. He held talks with both Röhm, the SA chief, and Count von Helldorff, the SA leader of Berlin. On April 26th, Goebbels noted that Schleicher had informed Helldorff he wanted to change his course. 2 days later, Schleicher saw Hitler, and Goebbels reported that the talk went off well. Even at this stage of the game, it is evident that with regard to one question, Röhm and Schleicher were conspiring behind Hitler's back. Both men wanted the SA incorporated into the army as a militia, a step to which the Führer was unalterably opposed. This was a matter over which Hitler had often quarreled with his SA chief of staff, who saw the stormtroopers as a potential military force to strengthen the country, whereas Hitler regarded them as purely a political force, a band to strike terror in the streets against his political opponents and to keep up political enthusiasm in the Nazi ranks. But in his conversations with the Nazi leaders, Schleicher had another objective in mind. He wanted the SA attached to the army, where he could control it, but he also wanted Hitler, the only conservative nationalist with any mass following, in the government, where he could control him. The Verbot of the SA hindered progress toward both objectives. By the end of the first week of May 1932, Schleicher's intrigues reached one of their climaxes. Goebbels notes on May 4th that Hitler's mines are beginning to go off. First Gruner and then Brüning must go. On May 8th, Goebbels reported in his diary, Hitler had a decisive conference with General Schleicher and with some gentlemen close to the president. Everything goes well. Brüning will fall in a few days. The president will withdraw his confidence in him. He then outlines the plan which Schleicher and the president's Camarilla had hatched with Hitler. The Reichstag will be dissolved, a presidential cabinet will be installed, and all prohibitions against the SA and the Nazi Party lifted. To avoid arousing Brüning's suspicion of what is up, Goebbels adds, Hitler will keep away from Berlin. Late that evening, he spirits his chief away to Mecklenburg and into virtual hiding. For the Nazis, the presidential cabinet is regarded, Goebbels notes the next day, as merely an interim affair. Such a colorless transitional government, he says, will clear the way for us. The weaker it is, the easier we can do away with it. This, of course, is not the view of Schleicher, who already is dreaming of a new government which will dispense with Parliament until the Constitution can be changed, and which he will dominate. Already it is clear he and Hitler believe they can each get the best of the other. But for the moment he has an ace to play. He can assure the tired old president that he can offer what Brüning could not, a government supported by Hitler and yet without the inconvenience of having the fanatical demagogue in it. So, all was ready, and on May 10th, 2 days after his meeting with Hitler and the men around Hindenburg, Schleicher struck. The blow was delivered at the Reichstag. General Gruner rose to defend the banning of the SA and was violently attacked by Goering. Ill with diabetes and sick at heart at the treachery already wrought by Schleicher, the defense minister tried to defend himself as best he could, but he was overwhelmed by a torrent of abuse from the Nazi benches. Exhausted and humiliated, he started to leave the chamber only to run into General von Schleicher, who informed him coldly that he no longer enjoyed the confidence of the army and must resign. Gruner appealed to Hindenburg, for whom he had loyally fronted and taken the blame when the crucial moment had come, first in 1918 to tell the Kaiser to go, and then in 1919 to advise the Republican government to sign the Versailles Treaty. But the old field marshal, who had never ceased resenting his obligation to the younger officer, replied that he regretted he could do nothing in the matter. On May 13th, bitter and disillusioned, Gruner resigned. That evening, Goebbels recorded in his diary, "We have news from General Schleicher. Everything is going according to plan." "Scorn and rage boil within me," Gruner wrote Schleicher a few months later, November 29th. "Because I have been deceived in you, my old friend, disciple, adopted son." See Gordon A. Craig, Reichswehr and National Socialism, The Policy of Wilhelm Gruner, Political Science Quarterly, June 1948. The plan called for Brüning's head next, and it was not long before the conniving general was able to slip it on the block. Gruner's fall had been a grave setback for the tottering republic, almost alone among the military men he had served it ably and devotedly, and there was no one else in the army of his stature and loyalty to replace him. But the stubborn, hard-working Brüning was still a power. He had secured the backing of the majority of Germans for Hindenburg's re-election, and, as he believed, for the continuance of the republic. He seemed to be on the eve of sensational successes in foreign policy with regard to both the cancellation of reparations and equality of armament for the Reich. But the aging president, as we have seen, had rewarded with a remarkable coolness the chancellor's superhuman efforts in winning him a further term of office. His attitude became more frigid when Brüning proposed that the state take over a number of bankrupt Junker estates in East Prussia, after generous compensation, and give them to the landless peasants. When Hindenburg went off for the Easter holidays at the middle of May to Neudeck, the East Prussian estate which the Junkers, with the financial help of the industrialists, had given him as a present on his 80th birthday, he got an earful from his aristocratic neighbors, who clamored for the dismissal of a chancellor whom they now called an agrarian Bolshevist. The Nazis, undoubtedly through Schleicher, learned before Brüning that the chancellor was on his way out. On May 18th, Goebbels returned from Munich to Berlin and, noting that the Easter spirit was still lingering, wrote in his diary, "For Brüning alone, winter seems to have set in. The funny thing is, he doesn't realize it. He can't find men for his cabinet. The rats are leaving the sinking ship." It might have been more accurate to say that the leading rat, far from leaving the sinking ship of state, was merely making ready to put in a new captain. The next day, Goebbels recorded, "General Schleicher has refused to take over the Ministry of Defense." This was true, but also not quite accurate. Brüning had indeed made the request of Schleicher after upbraiding him for undermining Gruner. "I will," Schleicher had replied, "but not in your government." On May 19th, Goebbels's diary recorded, "Message from Schleicher. The list of ministers is ready. For the transition period, it is not so important." Thus, at least a week in advance of Brüning, the Nazis knew his goose was cooked. On Sunday, May 29th, Hindenburg summoned Brüning to his presence and abruptly asked for his resignation, and on the following day it was given him. Schleicher had triumphed. But not only Brüning had fallen, the Democratic Republic went down with him, though its death agonies would continue for another 8 months before the final coup de grace was administered. Brüning's responsibility for its demise was not small. Though democratic at heart, he had allowed himself to be maneuvered into a position where he had perforce to rule much of the time by presidential decree without the consent of Parliament. The provocation to take such a step, admittedly, had been great. The politicians, in their blindness, had made it all but inevitable. As recently as May 12th, though, he had been able to win a vote of confidence in the Reichstag for his finance bill. But where Parliament could not agree, he had relied on the authority of the President to govern. Now that authority had been withdrawn. From now on, for From June 1932 to January 1933, it would be granted to two lesser men who, though not Nazis, felt no urge to uphold a democratic republic, at least as it was presently constituted. The political power in Germany no longer resided, as it had since the birth of the republic, in the people and in the body which expressed the people's will, the Reichstag. It was now concentrated in the hands of a senile, 85-year-old president, and in those of a few shallow, ambitious men around him who shaped his weary, wandering mind. Hitler saw this very clearly, and it suited his purposes. It seemed most unlikely that he would ever win a majority in Parliament. Hindenburg's new course offered him the only opportunity that was left of coming to power. Not at the moment, to be sure, but soon. He hurried back to Berlin from Oldenburg, where on May 29th the Nazis had won an absolute majority in the election for the local Diet. The next day he was received by Hindenburg, who confirmed the points of the deal which the Nazi leader had secretly worked out with Schleicher on May 8th. The lifting of the ban on the SA, a presidential cabinet of Hindenburg's own choosing, dissolution of the Reichstag. Would Hitler support the new government? Hindenburg asked. Hitler replied that he would. That evening of May 30th, Goebbels's diary was brought up to date. Hitler's talk with the president went well. V. Papen is spoken of as chancellor, but that interests us little. The important thing is that the Reichstag is dissolved. Elections, elections, direct to the people. We are all very happy. Fiasco of Franz von Papen. There now appeared briefly on the center of the stage an unexpected and ludicrous figure. The man whom General von Schleicher foisted upon the octogenarian president, and who on June 1, 1932 was named Chancellor of Germany, was the 53-year-old Franz von Papen, scion of an impoverished family of the Westphalian nobility, a former general staff officer, a crack gentleman rider, an unsuccessful and amateurish Catholic centrist politician, a wealthy industrialist by marriage and little known to the public except as a former military attaché in Washington, who had been expelled during the war for complicity in the planning of such sabotage as blowing up bridges and railroad lines, while the United States was neutral. The president's choice met with incredulity, wrote the French ambassador in Berlin. No one but smiled or tittered or laughed because Papen enjoyed the peculiarity of being taken seriously by neither his friends nor his enemies. He was reputed to be superficial, blundering, untrue, ambitious, vain, crafty, and an intriguer. To such a man, and Monsieur François Poncet was not exaggerating, Hindenburg, at Schleicher's prompting, had entrusted the fate of the floundering republic. Papen had no political backing whatsoever. He was not even a member of the Reichstag. The furthest he had got in politics was a seat in the Prussian Landtag. On his appointment as chancellor, his own center party, indignant at the treachery of Papen toward its leader, Brüning, unanimously expelled him from the party. But the president had told him to form a government above parties, and this he was able to do at once because Schleicher already had a list of ministers at hand. It comprised what became known as the Baron's Cabinet. Five members were of the nobility, two were corporation directors, and one, Franz Gürtner, named Minister of Justice, had been Hitler's protector in the Bavarian government during the troubled days before and after the Beer Hall Putsch. General von Schleicher was smoked out by Hindenburg from his preferred position behind the scenes and made Minister of Defense. The Baron's Cabinet was received by much of the country as a joke, though the stamina of a number of its members, Baron von Neurath, Baron von Eltz-Rubinach, Count Schwerin von Krosigk, and Dr. Gürtner, was such that they lingered on at their posts far into the era of the Third Reich. Papen's first act was to honor Schleicher's pact with Hitler. On June 4th, he dissolved the Reichstag and convoked new elections for July 31st. And after some prodding from the suspicious Nazis, he lifted the ban on the SA on June 15th. A wave of political violence and murder such as even Germany had not previously seen immediately followed. The stormtroopers swarmed the streets seeking battle and blood, and their challenge was often met, especially by the communists. In Prussia alone, between June 1st and 20th, there were 461 pitched battles in the streets which cost 82 lives and seriously wounded 400 men. In July, 38 Nazis and 30 communists were listed among the 86 persons killed in riots. On Sunday, July 10th, 18 persons were done to death in the streets, and on the following Sunday, when the Nazis, under police escort, staged a march through Altona, a working-class suburb of Hamburg, 19 persons were shot dead and 285 wounded. The civil war, which the Baron's cabinet had been called in to halt, was growing steadily worse. All the parties, save the Nazis and the communists, demanded that the government take action to restore order. Papen responded by doing two things. He banned all political parades for the fortnight prior to the July 31st elections. And he took a step which was aimed not only at placating the Nazis, but at destroying one of the few remaining pillars of the Democratic Republic. On July 20th, he deposed the Prussian government and appointed himself Reich Commissioner for Prussia. This was a daring move toward the kind of authoritarian government he was seeking for the whole of Germany. Papen's excuse was that the Altona riots had shown the Prussian government could not maintain law and order. He also charged, on evidence hastily produced by Schleicher, that the Prussian authorities were in cahoots with the communists. When the socialist ministers refused to be deposed except by force, Papen obligingly supplied it. Martial law was proclaimed in Berlin, and General von Rundstedt, the local Reichswehr commander, sent a lieutenant and a dozen men to make the necessary arrests. This was a development which was not lost on the men of the right who had taken over the federal power, nor did it escape Hitler's notice. There was no need to worry any longer that the forces of the left or even of the democratic center would put up serious resistance to the overthrow of the democratic system. In 1920, a general strike had saved the republic from being overthrown. Such a measure was debated now among the trade union leaders and the socialists and rejected as too dangerous. Thus, by deposing the constitutional Prussian government, Papen had driven another nail into the coffin of the Weimar Republic. It had taken, as he boasted, only a squad of soldiers to do it. For their part, Hitler and his lieutenants were determined to bring down not only the Republic, but Papen and his barons, too. Goebbels expressed the aim in his diary on June 5th. We must disassociate ourselves at the earliest possible moment from this transitional bourgeois cabinet. When Papen saw Hitler for the first time on June 9th, the Nazi leader told him, I regard your cabinet only as a temporary solution and will continue my efforts to make my party the strongest in the country. The chancellorship will then devolve on me. The Reichstag elections of July 31st were the third national elections held in Germany within 5 months. But, far from being weary from so much electioneering, the Nazis threw themselves into the campaign with more fanaticism and force than ever before. Despite Hitler's promise to Hindenburg that the Nazis would support the Papen government, Goebbels unleashed bitter attacks on the Minister of the Interior, and as early as July 9th, Hitler went to Schleicher and complained bitterly of the government's policies. From the size of the crowds that turned out to see Hitler, it was evident that the Nazis were gaining ground. In one day, July 27th, he spoke to 60,000 persons in Brandenburg, to nearly as many in Potsdam, and that evening to 120,000 massed in the giant Grunewald Stadium in Berlin, while outside an additional 100,000 heard his voice by loudspeaker. The polling on July 31st brought a resounding victory for the National Socialist Party. With 13,745,000 votes, the Nazis won 230 seats in the Reichstag, making them easily the largest party in Parliament, though still far short of a majority in a house of 608 members. The Social Democrats, no doubt because of the timidity shown by their leaders in Prussia, lost 10 seats and were reduced to 133. The working class was swinging over to the Communists, who gained 12 seats and became the third largest party, with 89 members in the Reichstag. The Catholic Center increased its strength somewhat, from 68 to 73 seats, but the other middle-class parties, and even Hugenberg's German National Party, the only one which had supported Papen in the election, were overwhelmed. Except for the Catholics, the middle and upper classes, it was evident, had gone over to the Nazis. On August 2nd, Hitler took stock of his triumph at Tegernsee, near Munich, where he conferred with his party leaders. Since the last Reichstag elections 2 years before, The National Socialists had gained over 7 million votes and increased their representation in Parliament from 107 to 230. In the 4 years since the 1928 elections, the Nazis had won some 13 million new votes. Yet the majority which would sweep the party into power still eluded Hitler. He had won only 37% of the total vote. The majority of Germans was still against him. Far into the night, he deliberated with his lieutenants. Goebbels recorded the results in his diary entry of August 2nd. The Führer faces difficult decisions. Legal? With the center? With the center, the Nazis could form a majority in the Reichstag. But to Goebbels, this is unthinkable. Still, he notes, the Führer comes to no final decision. The situation will take a little time to ripen. But not much. Hitler, flushed with his victory, though it was less than decisive, was impatient. On August 4th, he hurried to Berlin to see not Chancellor von Papen, but General von Schleicher, and, as Goebbels noted, to present his demands. They will not be too moderate, he added. On August 5th, at the Fürstenberg barracks near Berlin, Hitler outlined his terms to General von Schleicher. The chancellorship for himself, and for his party, the premiership of Prussia, the Reich and Prussian Ministries of Interior, the Reich Ministries of Justice, Economy, and Aviation, and a new ministry for Goebbels, that of Popular Enlightenment and Propaganda. As a sop to Schleicher, Hitler promised him the defense ministry. Furthermore, Hitler said he would demand an enabling act from the Reichstag, authorizing him to rule by decree for a specified period. If it were refused, the Reichstag would be sent home. Hitler left the meeting convinced that he had won over Schleicher to his program and hurried south in good spirits to his mountain retreat on the Obersalzberg. Goebbels, always cynical in regard to the opposition and always distrustful of the political general, was not so sure. It is well to be skeptical about further developments, he confided to his diary on August 6th after he had listened to the leader's optimistic report of his meeting with Schleicher. Goebbels was sure of one thing, though. Once we have the power, we will never give it up. They will have to carry our dead bodies out of the ministries. All was not as well as Hitler seemed to think. On August 8th, Goebbels wrote, "Telephone call from Berlin. It is full of rumors. The whole party is ready to take over power. The SA men are leaving their places of work in order to make themselves ready. The party leaders are preparing for the great hour. If all goes well, fine. If things go badly, there will be a terrible setback." The next day, Strasser, Frick, and Funk arrived at Obersalzberg with news that was not exactly encouraging. Schleicher was turning again, like a worm. He was now insisting that if Hitler got the chancellorship, he must rule with the consent of the Reichstag. Funk reported that his business friends were worried about the prospects of a Nazi government. He had a message from Schacht confirming it. Finally, the Wilhelmstrasse, the trio told Hitler, was worried about a Nazi putsch. This worry was not without foundation. Next day, August 10th, Goebbels learned that in Berlin the SA was in a state of armed readiness. The SA is throwing an ever stronger ring around Berlin. The Wilhelmstrasse is very nervous about it. But that is the point of our mobilization. On the following day, the Führer could stand the waiting no longer. He set out by motor car for Berlin. He would make himself scarce there, Goebbels says, but on the other hand, he would be ready when he was called. When the call did not come, he himself requested to see the president. But first he had to see Schleicher and Papen. This interview took place at noon on August 13th. It was a stormy one. Schleicher had slid away from his position of a week before. He supported Papen in insisting that the most Hitler could hope for was the vice-chancellorship. Hitler was outraged. He must be chancellor or nothing. Papen terminated the interview by saying he would leave the final decision up to Hindenburg. Papen, in his memoirs, does not mention Schleicher's presence at this meeting, but it is clear from other sources that he was there. It is an important point in view of subsequent events. Hitler retired in a huff to the nearby Kaiserhof. There at 3 p.m., a phone call came from the president's office. Someone, probably Goebbels, judging from his diary, asked, "Has a decision already been made? If so, there is no point in Hitler's coming over." The president, the Nazis were told, wishes first to speak to Hitler. The aging field marshal received the Nazi leader standing up and leaning on his cane in his study, thus setting the icy tone for the interview. For a man in his 85th year, who only 10 months before had suffered a complete mental relapse lasting more than a week, Hindenburg was in a surprisingly lucid frame of mind. He listened patiently while Hitler reiterated his demand for the chancellorship and full power. Otto von Meissner, chief of the presidential chancellery, and Goering, who had accompanied Hitler, were the only witnesses to the conversation, and though Meissner is not a completely dependable source, his affidavit at Nuremberg is the only first-hand testimony in existence of what followed. It has a ring of truth. Hindenburg replied that because of the tense situation, he could not in good conscience risk transferring the power of government to a new party such as the National Socialists, which did not command a majority and which was intolerant, noisy, and undisciplined. At this point, Hindenburg, with a certain show of excitement, referred to several recent occurrences, clashes between the Nazis and the police, acts of violence committed by Hitler's followers against those who were of a different opinion, excesses against Jews, and other illegal acts. All these incidents had strengthened him in his conviction that there were numerous wild elements in the party beyond control. After extended discussion, Hindenburg proposed to Hitler that he should declare himself ready to cooperate with the other parties, in particular with the right and center, and that he should give up the one-sided idea that he must have complete power. In cooperating with other parties, Hindenburg declared, he would be able to show what he could achieve and improve upon. If he could show positive results, he would acquire increasing and even dominating influence, even in a coalition government. Hindenburg stated that this also would be the best way to eliminate the widespread fear that a National Socialist government would make ill use of its power, and would suppress all other viewpoints and gradually eliminate them. Hindenburg stated that he was ready to accept Hitler and the representatives of his movement in a coalition government, the precise combination to be a matter of negotiation, but that he could not take the responsibility of giving exclusive power to Hitler alone. Hitler was adamant, however, in refusing to put himself in the position of bargaining with the leaders of the other parties and in such manner to form a coalition government. The discussion then ended without agreement, but not before the old president, still standing, had delivered a stern lecture to the Nazi leader. In the words of the official communique issued immediately afterward, Hindenburg regretted that Herr Hitler did not see himself in a position to support a national government appointed with the confidence of the Reich president, as he had agreed to do before the Reichstag elections. In the view of the venerable president, Hitler had broken his word, but let him beware of the future. The president, the communique stated further, gravely exhorted Herr Hitler to conduct the opposition on the part of the NS party in a chivalrous manner, and to bear in mind his responsibility to the fatherland and to the German people. The communique giving Hindenburg's version of the meeting and insisting that Hitler had demanded complete control of the state was published in such a hurry that it caught Goebbels's propaganda machine napping and did much harm to Hitler's cause, not only among the general public but among the Nazis themselves. In vain did Hitler respond that he had not asked for complete power, but only for the chancellorship and a few ministries. Hindenburg's word was generally accepted. In the meantime, the mobilized stormtroopers were chafing at the bit. Hitler called in their leaders and spoke to them that same evening. "It's a difficult task," Goebbels noted. "Who knows if their formations can be held together? Nothing is more difficult than to tell victory-flushed troops that victory has been snatched out of their hand." Late that night, the little doctor sought consolation in the reading of the letters of Frederick the Great. Next day he raced off for a vacation on the beaches of the Baltic. "Great hopelessness reigns among the party comrades," he wrote. He declined to leave his room even to speak with them. "I don't want to hear about politics for at least a week. I want only sun, light, air, and peace." Hitler retired to the Obersalzberg to imbibe the same elements and ponder the immediate future. As Goebbels said, the first big chance has been missed. Hermann Rauschning, the then Nazi leader in Danzig, found the Führer brooding sullenly on his mountaintop. "We must be ruthless," Hitler told him, and launched into a tirade against Papen. But he had not lost hope. At times he spoke as if he were already chancellor. "My task is more difficult than Bismarck's," he said. "I must first create the nation before even beginning to tackle the national tasks before us." But supposing the Nazis were suppressed by a military dictatorship under Papen and Schleicher? Hitler abruptly asked Rauschning whether Danzig, an independent city-state then under the protection of the League of Nations, had an extradition agreement with Germany. Rauschning did not at first understand the question, but it later became evident that Hitler was looking for a place that might serve as an asylum. In his diary, Goebbels noted, "Rumors that the Führer is to be arrested." Yet even now, after his rebuff by the Reich president and the government of Papen and Schleicher, and despite his fears that his party might be outlawed, he was determined to stick to his path of legality. He squelched all talk of a putsch by the SA. Except for occasional spells of depression, he remained confident that he would achieve his goal. Not by force, and scarcely by winning a parliamentary majority, but by the means which had carried Schleicher and Papen to the top. By backstairs intrigue, a game that two could play. It was not long before he gave an example. On August 25th, Goebbels conferred with Hitler at Berchtesgaden and noted, "We have got into touch with the Center Party, if only to bring pressure on our opponents." Next day, Goebbels was back in Berlin, where he found that Schleicher had already found out about our feelers to the center. On the following day, he went to see the general just to make sure. He thought Schleicher appeared worried at the prospect of Hitler and the Catholic Center getting together, for between them they commanded an absolute majority in the Reichstag. As to Schleicher, Goebbels wrote, "I don't know what is genuine or false in him." The contacts with the Center Party, though never intended, as Goebbels said, to be much more than a means of applying pressure on the Papen government, paid off in a farcical event which now occurred in the Reichstag, and which marked the beginning of the end for the cavalryman chancellor. When the chamber convened on August 30th, the centrists joined the Nazis in electing Göring president of the Reichstag. For the first time, then, a National Socialist was in the chair when the Reichstag reconvened on September 12th to begin its working session. Göring made the most of his opportunity. Chancellor von Papen had obtained in advance from the president a decree for the dissolution of the chamber, the first time that the death warrant of the Reichstag had been signed before it met to transact business. But for this first working session, he neglected to bring it along. He had with him instead a speech outlining the program of his government, having been assured that one of the nationalist deputies, in agreement with most of the other parties, would object to a vote on the expected communist motion for censure of the government. In this case, a single objection from any one of the 600-odd members was enough to postpone a vote. When Ernst Torgler, the communist leader, introduced his motion as an amendment to the order of the day, however, neither a nationalist deputy nor any other rose to object. Finally, Frick asked for a half-hour's adjournment on behalf of the Nazis. "The situation was now serious," Papen says in his memoirs, "and I had been caught unawares." He sent a messenger post-haste to the Chancellery to fetch the dissolution order. In the meantime, Hitler conferred with his parliamentary party group in the Reichstag President's Palace across the street. The Nazis were in a dilemma, and they were embarrassed. The nationalists, they felt, had double-crossed them by not moving to postpone the vote. Now, Hitler's party, in order to bring down the Papen government, would have to vote with the communists on a communist motion. Hitler decided to swallow the pill of such an unsavory association. He ordered his deputies to vote for the communist amendment and overthrow Papen before the chancellor could dissolve the Reichstag. To accomplish this, of course, Göring, as presiding officer, would have to pull some fast and neat tricks of parliamentary procedure. The former air ace, a man of daring and of many abilities, as he was to prove on a larger stage later, was equal to the occasion. When the session reconvened, Papen appeared with the familiar red dispatch case, which, by tradition, carried the dissolution order he had so hastily retrieved. But when he requested the floor to read it, the president of the Reichstag managed not to see him, though Papen, by now red-faced, was on his feet brandishing the paper for all in the assembly to see. All but Göring. His smiling face was turned the other way. He called for an immediate vote. By now, Papen's countenance, according to eyewitnesses, had turned from red to white with anger. He strode up to the president's rostrum and plunked the dissolution order on his desk. Göring took no notice of it and ordered the vote to proceed. Papen, followed by his ministers, none of whom were members of the chamber, stalked out. The deputies voted, 513-32 against the government. Only then did Göring notice the piece of paper which had been thrust so angrily on his desk. He read it to the Assembly and ruled that since it had been countersigned by a Chancellor who already had been voted out of office by a constitutional majority, it had no validity. Which elements in Germany gained and which lost by